are listening to True Crime Fiction, feeding your addiction to the best of the written and the spoken word in crime. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so for as little as £1 at patreon.com/truecrimefiction.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello and welcome to Hercule Durkle. Today we'll be looking at, what are we going to look at? My Dark Places.
My Dark Parts. Or is it Places?
Yes, oh my Dark Places.
My Dark Places.
My Dark Parts is something else. By,
James Ellroy.
James Ellroy.
And I'm Mari.
And I'm Phil. And we will also be remarking on a documentary made in 2001 called Feast of Death, which was a BBC Arena documentary. And we'll also be referencing Fanfaronade, I think, on our Fanfaronade, an article by Will Self in the London Review of Books. And we will at some later point, and probably in a different episode, reference all of this in relation to Baby Reindeer by Richard Gadd.
Richard Gadd, yes. So we've recently watched Baby Reindeer. We've also been reading My Dark Places, and we saw a lot of similar things in both of them. And we wanted to kind of meld them together in an episode, but then realised there's way too much to say about James Ellroy. So it's probably going to be a two-parter.
And also, as you had pointed out, the likelihood is that people may not have come across the work by James Ellroy, whereas everyone's talking about Baby Reindeer right now. So I think it's good to do a deep dive into the Ellroy book and then look at the parallels and the themes in the two works at a later point.
Okay.
So let's talk about the work. I suppose also I wanted to maybe talk or think about how we approach the Hercule Durkle project and look more at the work rather than the subject matter. I feel like in the last episode, for my liking, spoke a little too much about the crime. We could have spoken more about that podcast on this from the News of the... No, not News of the World. Sunday World. I'm catching it from you.
You are.
Because I think that was really very... It was a really interesting work. I think it was really good. And I think it showed, like, if when you compare that work compared to other podcasts, you can really tell that she's a hard-nosed tabloid journalist with decades of experience. She knew how to make a story and, you know, keep you informed and interested the whole way through. Yeah, let's look at it. What is it exactly?
So it is a memoir by James Ellroy. People will probably know him best as the writer of LA Confidential, which was a massive hit. He's written a lot of crime fiction. It's quite often set in that era of the 30s, 40s, 50s in LA. He's got a kind of noir-y, hard-boiled edge to him and a style of writing, which I think we sort of described as telegraphic in essence. And
what can you describe telegraphic in the style?
So it's kind of, there's no extra words. He's never going to spend time beautifully describing a flower to give you a sense of ambiance. You know, it's about the story, it's about the people, it's about what's happening.
It's the facts, Jack.
Yeah, and it's really direct and it's quite fast paced as well because of that.
Yeah, I mean, it fits in with the classic noir style. Who are the classic noir?
Well, Raymond Chandler's
Chandler, Hammett. What's interesting is that they were writing in the 40s, right, and 50s, whereas Elroy's writing in the 80s and 90s, but setting it in the same world. So he's always been kind of a bit different because of that, but and maybe more self-aware in the use of that style. But as we'll come across, it the style actually reflects his personality.
Yeah.
Quite well.
And also his obsession, mm-hmm. I think, too, because he's very obsessed with that time frame.
Yeah, and his focus on the narrative as well, and the focus on the detail.
Mm.
This all will come out in the course of this book. And what is a memoir? And is it an autobiography, or what is the difference?
So I would say there is definitely a difference between autobiography and memoir. The sort of thing that would go under autobiography would be when you have a figure who is notable historically or culturally, and another person comes along and kind of will go to a lot of source material, possibly interview people who may have known or worked with that person. And it's kind of a much more academic look, whereas a memoir is often written in a much more kind of, I mean, it's about people's memories. So with people's memories, there are, you know, the biases, the lenses we choose to see the world through. If you write a memoir, you're not exactly saying that it's the absolute truth and fact. It's more your interpretation of what has happened. So memoir is kind of maybe a bit trickier, a bit more slippy in the way it is, whereas an autobiography would be sort of much more factual. And I've just realised I described a biography, not an autobiography.
But still, an autobiography, I think, has the same. It's more faithful to representing the life story of the subject.
Yeah, I think there's a...
Whereas a memoir is more impressionistic.
Yes, there's more of an expectation of accuracy, I think, with the biography or autobiography. Whereas memoir, you might choose to not write a whole person's life. You might choose to look at a very specific part of a person's life, or a theme throughout the person's life.
So this is very much a memoir.
So it is a memoir, definitely, but there is also some sort of biographical detail in it, because My Dark Places is particularly sort of investigating Elroy's relationship with the death of his mother, who was murdered when he was very young. I think, was he 6 or 7?
He was 10.
Okay, still very young. There's not a good age to have your parent murdered at, I expect.
Nope.
And obviously that's a formative age as well, and what really comes through is the way that one incident has kind of coloured his whole life. And in the book, he will sometimes be using sort of police interview transcripts and very factual documents. And then at other points, he will talk about how he feels about his mother and use prose, which is quite close to poetry in some ways as well. So it has a lot of different styles within it.
I would go as far as I'd say that it's not, it's more than coloured. It's forged his character by this. I mean, it's the formative event that shapes everything that happens to him subsequently in life.
Yeah.
And it doesn't abate remarkably.
Yeah.
It's really intense at the beginning and remains so throughout.
It feels like there's maybe a small, towards the end, a bit of a acceptance, a small shift in his perspective, but then he quite quickly comes back with the, no, I'm always going to be obsessed by this.
Yeah, I think it certainly there's a change in his impression of his mother, or his image of her changes, but his obsession never goes away.
Yeah. And to be honest, I could see that being the truth for many people who've gone through such a traumatic event at such an early age.
Yeah. And I mean, our interest in this and the themes we want to explore and maybe bring together with Baby Reindeer are the effect of trauma on a person and how they process it and deal with it mm-hmm. in healthy and unhealthy ways, and how then for some people, and these two people in particular, they use that as the source of their creative output.
Yeah.
And it is interesting how these two different people have experienced very different types of trauma and different ages and are very different people, but yet there are very strong parallels between them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So let's get on with the book. And it's broken into four parts.
Yeah.
And the first part is a description of the murder of his mother, but done as if it were crime fiction, like a fictional book that he had written in his, like his other novels, his other noir novels. He speaks about himself in the third person because he's obviously features in the story. It details in very specific detail the investigation that the police carry out.
Yeah, so everybody in this part is a real person who was involved. So it's very much not a fictionalized version, but as close, I think, as he can possibly get to it being factual, having used the case files and transcripts and notes from the original investigation. And yeah, it's very emotionally removed. It's really factual, and it has that sort of telegraph style as well, mm-hmm. which gives a sense of, I think later on in the book, you have almost a sense that that part's quite disconnected.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if he's doing it in this style as if it were a fictional piece, but it's the real facts. But those books are written from the perspective of the hard-nosed detective, and he's the son. And so that's where the detachment, I suppose, is apparent, is that he's not dealing with it as a member of the family.
Yeah.
He's emotionally affected by it. It's very cold and detailed.
Yeah. I actually found that first part really difficult to read. I think mainly because, I mean, I'm dyslexic and I have challenges reading anyway.
So you meant difficult not in a sense of like, oh, this is hard, this is disturbing.
No.
You meant in a sense of, oh, this is actually just difficult for me to kind of follow the thread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Partly, I've always found non-fiction difficult to read unless it's incredibly good narrative non-fiction, because I need to have something. So I have dyslexia, which makes reading difficult, but I also have ADHD, which means I have an interest-based nervous system. So if there's not something in there that's really interesting to me, I just don't have the motivation to push through. And I think if I had been listening to it on an audiobook, I would have been fine. But the sort of physical act of reading, I found really challenging.
Yeah, I really, really liked it. I thought it was, I could read it. I really like the noir style, the Chandler and Hammett and Elroy's other books. Of the descriptions of that time and in that style, that telegraphed style. So, and it was on, you know, because you know that it's actually describing a real events and real people and real suspects and real investigations. It's even more engaging for me. So there you go.
Yeah.
Each to their own. And why? Because you read the book. And you gave it to me to read. Why did you read it?
So I was actually listening to another true crime book by Maggie Nelson called The Red Parts, which is an extraordinary piece of writing. I've really enjoyed it. I've listened to it twice now, actually. And she is specifically kind of doing a similar thing with the murder of her aunt Jane. So her aunt was murdered before Maggie was even born, but like all murders, there's sort of trauma and it affects down the generations. So very late on, I think a good 40 years after the murder, the police managed to catch someone using DNA. There hadn't been DNA at the time, and they went to trial. And although Maggie hadn't known Jane, she feels that she has to be a witness for her aunt and goes and attends every day of the trial. And it's very beautifully written, particularly considering what a harsh emotive subject it actually is. And she really digs down into kind of how the trial, how the case makes her think about things and question things, and made her think about her mother and her mother's life and her grandfather. And it's as close as true crime gets to literary fiction, I would say, in writing terms.
Sorry, how long was the gap between the crime and the murder and the trial?
I'm not sure, but I think it was like a good 40, 50 years.
Right, because that's the same amount of time that Elroy, when he's writing the book and looking back at the murder.
Yeah.
So there's a parallel between the two.
There's a parallel between the two. And the reason why The Red Parts turned me on to My Dark Places is there's a scene in it where a producer of a TV show takes her out for dinner because he wants to do an episode on her aunt's murder and the trial. And he sort of says, let's go to Barnes & Noble. I'll buy you any book you want. And she buys James Elroy's My Dark Places. And I think she just had maybe a 2-sentence description of it or something. But I was like, ah, I know that name. I'm going to see if I can read that one too. So it's kind of a chain of quite literary true crime.
Okay, very interesting how we get to these places.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on then with the book part. So part one ends with nothing, no suspect being identified, or there's some suspects that have identikit portraits drawn up, but nobody is identified. There's no suspects.
Yeah, there's people they want to talk to, people who were seen with his mother, Geneva. But they kind of come up empty at every turn.
The swarthy man and the blonde.
Yeah, dishwater blonde as well. I always think that's such an insult. It's very passive-aggressive kind of way of describing a woman's hair, I think.
And swarthy's not exactly complimentary either.
Well, I think there was a time where swarthy was code for Greek or Italian.
Yeah, I mean, that's the implication in the book, is that that's his ethnicity. So that ends inconclusively. Mm-hmm. And the lead detectives, whose names I can't remember, Hallinan,
Lawton, and Bruton?
Well,
or Broughton?
Bruton, I suppose, if it's an Irish name. They investigate and are unsuccessful. Then we move to part two, which switches style completely and is much more memoir in its style.
I don't think that's how you pronounce it.
It's how John Malkovich pronounces it in Burn After Reading. I'm writing a memoir.
Is that like Nigella Lawson and her microwave?
Well, yeah, I don't know. It's supposed to be, I think he's trying to do it in a French way. Anyway, this is quite the shift in pace and style, right?
Mm, yeah.
And we have the story taken up from after the murder. He moves in with his father. And basically it all goes downhill from there.
Yeah, it's...
It's quite incredible. Yeah. The he really falls apart in such a large way.
I think it's fair to say his father really lacked parenting skills. He didn't even just lack parenting skills. I just don't think he cared.
He just wasn't a nice guy.
He was not. He was, after having gone through such a traumatic event, he was probably the worst person.
I mean, it's hard to say whether... I mean, I would imagine that James Ellroy would have ended up the same anyway, but he certainly didn't help. His father certainly did not help.
Yeah. I mean, he carried on criticizing his mother to James even after she was murdered and telling him things like that she was a prostitute and blah, blah, blah.
And just a drunk.
Kind of psychopath. I mean, the thing is, she was teetering on the edge of alcoholism.
Yeah.
So that's not without some basis, but and you don't need to tell that to a 10-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, that had happened before her death as well. He had been, you know, after they'd split up, he had been trying to put her down when he was with him, with James Ellroy, the son. He constantly bad-mouthing the mother and basically making it a competition.
Yeah.
That James Ellroy had to choose a parent. His father's kind of aggressive approach to this meant that he fell for it and decided he wanted to be with his dad. And then held, I don't know what the word is. He was, held his mother in disdain.
Yeah, like the parental alienation really worked incredibly well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think is part of why it was so difficult for him to process his mother's murder, because he had such stark negative feelings about her, while still obviously also loving her as well. And I just think that gave him a real burden for the rest of his life. But even on top of that, it wasn't like his father was indulging in this parental alienation, but also being a great dad in every other aspect. Like, there was no food. He wasn't making sure that James went to school. He was getting him involved in all kinds of shenanigans. And, I mean, I think James Ellroy said that at one point they left one apartment and the whole place, they'd had a dog that they just let shit all over the floor and the whole place had to be fumigated.
Yeah.
So it's unhealthy on a physical level, on an emotional level.
And his, the reason that his parents split up and divorced in the first place was, well, one of the major reasons was that his father was completely work shy.
Yes.
He didn't really like to work and spent most of his time sitting on the couch reading. And that's, I mean, where he encouraged James Ellroy to get into reading and get into literature from a very early age. He taught him to read, I think, at the age of like 4 or something. So, I mean, he did give him that, which is, you know, is interesting, because that's, you know, writing and literature was how he got out of the mess he was in. So that's one small chink of light there, perhaps. Yeah. But in all other aspects, his father was a shit.
Yeah. The man's not going to win any parenting awards. So as you can imagine, young James does not have a grief counsellor or a therapist or, you know, any of the sort of support or structures you would expect. And his mother's family are on the other side of the country, I think.
Minnesota.
Yeah. Midwest, is that?
Yeah, that's like a kind of Fargo country.
Yeah, I just know it from Fargo.
Yeah, great accents.
Yeah. So there isn't really anyone else, and he's left floundering with all of this stuff that's so complex and complicated, and like, as an adult, you'd struggle with it. But he's just a kid. So he goes on a terrible spiral.
Yeah, I mean, he starts off in school. I mean, he starts being confrontational and deliberately offensive and adopting essentially a Nazi persona, a Nazi sympathetic persona.
In a school which was majority Jewish.
In Jewish school, which, I mean, he's doing it to shock. And he also described how he wanted to come across as a weirdo so that people would leave him alone. It was kind of a self-preservation technique. I don't know if it was well advised, but yeah, so but he really seems to take this to quite extremes and it doesn't let up. And
he's not a man of half measures.
No. So he really gets stuck into this and he pisses off everyone. You know, they seem quite, to be fair to this people in the school, they seem quite liberal and, you know, indulge him in this. But even they get sick of him.
Yeah, I mean, he's essentially feral.
Mm. And yeah, I think he starts to not really attend school that much. And he's just biking around on his own. Just, you know, as you say, feral.
Yeah.
There's a brief stint in the army.
Which he didn't last long.
Which he didn't last long in. And then basically he's hanging out with his... Does he go to university? Or a college of any kind?
I think it was maybe a half-hearted attempt at college.
Mm, but yeah, it's not stuck with. And he's hanging out with some friends who he makes from school. And yeah, I don't know what else. What are the details of this spiral do we need to bring up?
So he gets heavily into drugs, particularly, was it asthma inhalers?
Yeah.
He was using the medication and asthma inhalers and was putting away a huge amount of it. Like, to be honest, I'm surprised he's alive.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the end of it. I mean, there was the breaking into people's houses, which kind of preceded that.
Yeah, stalking women, staking out their family homes, waiting till the family's out, breaking into their houses, stealing their prescription medication, and to top it all off, stealing the underwear of the women and girls he's stalking, which is, that was the point which actually I felt most uncomfortable with, I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously pushing boundaries.
I mean, you're kind of getting into sex crime territory there, really.
Yeah. I mean, he's pushing boundaries.
I think that's a very nice way to say getting into sex crime.
Well, I mean, that's what it is, you know. I mean, it's, he could, yeah, push it further and further and further. But that, you know, it's a betrayal of, it's a very honest portrayal as well. He doesn't shy away from any of these details. He's that's sort of quite a refreshing aspect of the book, is his searing honesty about his life.
Yeah, and it's a bit disarming in a way, his honesty. Even when he's doing things which are awful and he is behaving like a person who you absolutely would stay away from and keep it a very, very long distance from yourself or anyone you knew. There's something about the honesty of his recounting which is almost vulnerable in a way.
Yeah, and I mean, you know that he ends up as a very successful writer, so it's kind of intriguing to see this descent and just kind of wonder, well, where is it going to end and how does he, you know, where does the redemption come? But it doesn't, like, it goes down so far. It's quite unbelievable.
Yeah, he's hospitalised, isn't he? And the redemption comes for somebody who's had such a sort of wild, feral life, absolutely living on the edge. His redemption is one of the most boring things possible.
Well, I mean, it's you mean golf?
Yeah.
Right. He becomes a caddy, basically. And starts working in these kind of posh clubs outside LA. And it's really good in terms of getting you outdoors, getting your exercises. You know, lifting a full bag of clubs around 18 holes is quite the undertaking. And for a guy who was, yeah, probably extraordinarily unfit after years and years of this self-abuse and, you know, withering away, he obviously builds his strength up and his and his resolve, and he gets his shit together. And that's where we leave part two.
Kind of on the cusp of a new life. But then part three, there's a huge
another huge shift.
Time gap,
yeah,
between them, because in part three we have James Ellroy, who is the successful novelist who is writing in national magazines, who people want to talk to. Very, very different place from where he was in part two.
And it doesn't talk about any of that success or any of the kind of getting the writing and the his personal life. He mentions a couple of times a couple of marriages, I think, but only in very brief passing. So there's no kind of, none of his actual life that's relevant to his writing as, you know, directly is mentioned at all, which is quite a novel approach. And we instead, he writes a biography of some other guy.
But that's why it's memoir rather than,
I know,
autobiography as well, because it's about the theme of his mother. And that one was the big falling apart, which, although he doesn't talk about his mother a lot in it, is absolutely through every single sentence, like punctuation. So, yeah, in part three, we get introduced to Bill Stoner, who is an LA detective about to retire. And Stoner is possibly a very unfortunate name for someone who's going to be a cop, essentially.
He didn't seem bothered by it.
No, well, I think you probably get to a stage where it wouldn't bother you and people making fun of it would be a bit immature.
Like yourself?
Yeah. I have no problem in admitting that I sometimes have a very juvenile sense of humour.
So, Bill Stoner appears in the 2001 Arena documentary, Feast of Death.
Yes, such a dramatic title.
Like, Feast of Death.
Feast of Death.
The reason it's really called Feast of Death, because they're sitting around having a meal and it's loads of, like, murder cops.
Yeah, like it could be having a meal with some murder cops, but instead it's like Feast of Death. He's very dramatic.
Yes.
He's quite extra. I think that's how the young people would describe him.
Would they?
Extra.
And they are surprisingly similar in appearance. Both balding, kind of a little overweight, with moustaches. I find them hard to tell apart sometimes.
Really?
Yeah. This weird aspect of the book where he goes into detail about Bill Stoner and his life, brief biography, and then a description of his career, which where he ends up for about 15 years doing cold cases. He gets commandeered onto a cold case division. I don't know. And has to solve a case known as the Cotton Club case.
Which is, I think, reasonably well known.
Yeah, it's a movie made in the 80s, which was reasonably successful. And there was a murder of a producer that was related to the film. So, yeah, that was kind of shady. Shady dealings going on with the people who are financing the movies, which is very, it's a very noir LA theme. So they just go into the detail of that. And then some other pretty brutal crimes where there's kind of trying to chase down a suspect that they're pretty sure is the culprit, but they're finding it hard to pin it down. So showing Elwood's adoration of police and his fascination with brutal crime.
Yeah, and he very much, so he did a whole novel around the Black Dahlia case, which is a really well-known true crime case. It's, I think you could sort of see it as one of the iconic murders, and the murders that kind of reach iconic status, like Jack Ripper, etc., always tend to be the unsolved ones. And I think that's because they become iconic because they're unsolved, and because people can, you know, put a lot of their own interpretation in it. So that's one that they talk about quite a lot. Elroy talks a lot about it in his work. But also on Feast of Death, they have, I think, a whole sort of like round table discussing the Black Dahlia case at some point with all these cops, James Elroy and Nick Nolte, just sitting there in the background.
And that journalist who has that theory that you don't like?
Yeah, the doctor theory, which...
Bailey.
Yeah.
Well, we don't need to go into that.
No, we don't. If people are interested, though, I have done a couple of episodes on the Black Dahlia. So episode 130, Crime and Culture Portrayals of the Black Dahlia, which looks at several different podcasts about that murder. And also 140, Killer Fathers, Traumatized Sons, Legacy of the Black Dahlia and the Zodiac.
There's quite a few famous cases that kind of pepper this book. So there's the Cotton Club one we just mentioned. Black Dahlia gets mentioned because Elroy ties his mother's murder into the Black Dahlia. As he describes in the Feast of Death, you know, his mother's death was quite mundane, or murder in comparison. So the hyperbolic, as he calls it, murder of Black Dahlia is kind of like, he kind of superimposes his own grief and his own mother's murder onto that, and uses that to kind of process the emotions that he wants to process.
Yeah, I have to say almost everybody's murder is mundane compared to the Black Dahlia, who I think we probably should also say her name was Elizabeth Short.
Yes. There's also talk of Lana Turner and her daughter.
There was a shooting, wasn't there?
Her daughter killed her mother's lover, and he was like a gangster. And it was all very Hollywood.
Yeah.
All very noir. And then finally, at the end of the book, the final case is going on four doors down from O.J. Simpson's case.
Who just died
a week or so ago, yeah. Which is mad. And I mean, I was thinking that people are very dismissive of OJ, and, you know, I get the reason why, and there's no reason not to be dismissive of him. You kind of forget how big that case was at the time.
I don't, because we actually, in my school, they...
live streamed it.
Well, they did the version of live streaming we had at the time. For the result, I think they brought a television into the school canteen, so on lunch break we could see it. And that was the only other time we were allowed a television in the school canteen, was during the first Gulf War.
Wow. That's pretty... I mean, I don't know if I would have done that had I been a school principal, but there you go.
Well, enough of the teachers were like, we want to know.
Yeah.
I don't think it was like particularly necessarily for an educational perspective.
Probably not.
But yeah, TV in the canteen was very, very unusual. And OJ was the one time we were allowed. So I don't think it's ever seemed small to me. It seemed far away.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's very different from the Highlands of Scotland. But even though, like, as a kid, you didn't necessarily understand everything that was going around the case, it was still obvious it was really important.
I suppose we got into the fourth part, which is the reinvestigation. So he gets together with Bill Stoner, and the two of them partner up, and I suppose he gets to cosplay being a detective,
which I think is what he really wants to do.
Which is what he's always wanted to do. And I mean, it transpires, it's not unclear in the book, but it's explicitly mentioned in the documentary that, you know, he offered him a load of money to do it. I mean, it makes sense because he was retiring and he said, here, will you do this for me? And obviously there was a financial incentive to do that. So, yeah. So the both of them go on the road and yeah, this is a weird, because basically it's rehashing everything that went on in the first part of the book. So it's a
reinvestigation.
Oh, it's a reinvestigation, but the way he's put the book, he didn't need to do the first part and the fourth part. It's a reiteration of it. But I think it really works because you get a sense of this obsession, of this inability to leave it, of it kind of going around and around in his head. I think this way of presenting it really gets that across.
Yeah, and it's not just the obsession with his mother's death, which is very understandable, but there's also an obsession there with the police, with detectives.
Yeah, and their work I suppose when you obsess, you've gone through trauma and you're obsessing about the details of like of murder and violence against women, like the job of the detective is kind of what you're doing in your head anyway, which is like going over the details and trying to make sense of it and trying to come up with a suspect and going to everyone and asking them, you know, 100 times the same questions. It's what's going on in his head manifest.
Yeah. And I think when you watch the documentary, Feast of Death, it's basically him having a meal with his cop mates.
Yeah.
And you can see that he loves being around them. Mm-hmm. Like, he gets a lot out of being around them, but they also love being around him. And it's like this lovely symbiotic relationship where he gets inspiration and, I guess, acceptance as well from these people. But they also get a level of hero worship, which I'm sure a lot of police like don't necessarily bump into on a day-to-day basis, the point where they've made him a little fake police badge and they give it to him as an honorary policeman. And it's like these are all men in their 50s and 60s, but you can kind of see
the boys in them,
yeah. But in a sweet way, not in a weird icky way.
Yeah.
But in a sweet way. But well, I still
it is kind of weird. Not icky, but weird.
It's not icky, but it's unusual.
Yeah.
But, and it was like, wow, these guys are really into what they're doing.
Yeah. It's interesting around the table, when they're talking about the Black Dahlia, they're saying, and it kind of is going back to your point about how, you know, he was getting involved in these very iffy behaviors when he was a teenager in his early 20s. And I often, reading the book, thought about, like, what does Bill Stoner think of this?
Yeah.
And what are these guys? And actually, I remember now that in the story they're saying, you know, since what's remarkable about the Black Dahlia is that there was no repeat murder. You know, there was no further murders. The murderer didn't murder anymore, and thinking, well, what happened to him? You know, maybe he died, and then one of them pops up. Maybe he became a writer. So, I think they do have a kind of assessment on him.
Yes, I think so, and I think it's worth noting as well that although I see his underwear stealing as kind of low-level gateway into sex crime, it's only very recently as a culture we've kind of accepted that those more minor crimes, such as stealing underwear or flashing, are more than a nuisance. They're actually a signal that something's very wrong with this person and there needs to be some kind of intervention, because people escalate over time. On why was there no more Black Dahlia murders, actually, there's a whole theory that it could have been a serial killer who was escalating. I mean, there's a million theories.
Mm. And yeah, and I mean, this was also the reinvestigation. So this is happening 40 years roughly after the murder. Mm. And so you're talking about a completely different place. It all takes place in El Monte. Isn't that the name of the place?
I think so.
Yeah, and it's all right, like, they're kind of, it's the kind of the greater LA area. Every time I heard Wes Covina, I was thinking of that comedy.
Crazy Ex-Boyfriend.
Yeah.
That's as soon as I Crazy hear that name. Yeah. As soon as I hear that name, I immediately have like this little chorus of tap dancers in my head.
Yeah.
Going, Wes Covina.
Yes, I do too, unfortunately.
And that's never going to go away.
No, it's not. It's annoyingly catchy. I didn't even know that that's where it was. I thought it was somewhere in the Midwest. Okay, and so, yeah, this is a kind of a very futile and kind of sad undertaking, really, that this man who's now successful, has money, but decides to spend it on just going, getting a cop and cosplaying being a cop to look into his mother's murder, to obsess more about his mother's murder.
Yeah, I found it very sad, actually, because it just seems so obvious from the beginning that this isn't going to be one that has a resolution, or not a resolution that's nice and tidy and neat. But I think that might be the reason why we have part one. Because in part one, we see all the leads. We see them bashing their heads against the brick wall and we see them not getting anywhere.
Mm.
If we didn't have had part one, we might go in to this part where they're doing the reinvestigation thinking maybe something could happen. Maybe they will find it. It would have given us some hope.
Well, I mean, like you said with the book that you read that brought you to this, I mean, it is possible for a murder to be solved 40 years after the case, you know, with DNA and advances in technology.
And I would say we're going through a sort of unprecedented time in crime investigation at the moment, because there are a lot of cases that are suddenly being solved because of the DNA technology. But I mean, this book was released in the 90s and it wasn't quite as far on as it is now. And I think they weren't able to. They did have evidence from the case, the ligature that had been used to kill her. I think they had some clothes, but I don't think they were able to get any DNA off it. Like, DNA's really didn't come on an amazing amount.
Didn't mention it, I think. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it was like, what, 96-ish, so DNA was still very much in its infancy.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, so I kind of feel like, in a way, part one is a framing. It's a book that's kind of framed between these two investigations.
Yeah.
But part one is a foreshadowing as well.
And because part one is in the time, you feel like the investigation has potential. Whereas now, going back to it 40 years later, it's further away. It's out of reach. You know, there's nothing. All of the potential witnesses or people who might have had a connection with anyone involved at the time are dying or
infirm
or suffering from dementia. So, yeah, it's kind of it's a pointless task in that there's no real way to get suspect and to find to solve the case. But as he does admit, turns out that he's more interested in just investigating his mother.
I think the value in the process is not bringing someone to trial or being able to say this dead guy is probably my mother's killer. I think the value for him is actually doing the work of investigation. It's the journey the investigation takes him on in an emotional sense.
Yes. And it's...
But he's also not a spiritual person at all, so I don't think he sort of ever is quite so blatant about it, but that was certainly the impression I got.
And there's a weird part where he talks about his ability to, his memory and his ability to like summon anything into his mind in a darkened room, and like it's all very strange. I suppose it ends with him eventually, after trying to avoid it for a long time, going to his extended family, his aunt's family in Wisconsin, and reconnecting with them.
Yeah, and we actually see them on the documentary as well. We film him going up, and it seems like they've been visiting for a while now, and they know each other and are enjoying each other's company, which...
And yeah, they couldn't be more different.
Yeah.
Characters. I mean, in LA, straight-talking, opinionated guy, and these real salt-of-the-earth bumpkins from Wisconsin. But they obviously have found a way to bond, as families often do. And yeah, I mean, his style of speaking in the documentary and his style of writing, you know, it was really interesting to see him speak, you know, to camera and to being interviewed as well as to audiences when he was doing like talks at book signings, etc. He has a very abrasive style, very confrontational, very insulting.
Yeah.
He likes to shock people.
But he's funny with it as well. He's not just brutal.
No, I think, and I think he is, like, I think this is very much the persona that he adopted from his father. His father sounded like this type of guy. His father, you know, who was a bookkeeper, a work-shy bookkeeper who once worked for Rita Hayworth and kind of lived off that story for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I don't think I need to hear about Rita Hayworth. She was actually quite an amazing woman in her own right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sure, and I'm sure she got rid of him because he was...
for good reason.
And even then, just go on saying how every woman was a dyke and every man was a homo. Or I can't remember what else the derogatory term for homosexual
James
was.
Elroy has to constantly talk about how big his father's dick was as well.
Yeah.
Was it like 18 inches, apparently, or something?
Will Self does make comment of that. And, you know, his obsession with his mother as well. And his sexual desire for her is a very... Yeah, he bemoans the fact that he didn't just basically read some Freud and realize that that's quite normal.
He might have. The thing is, it might be that this is normal, but I do think...
He takes it to another level.
I think there's a different level here with Elroy because of all the trauma that has mixed into this.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly lets his fantasy take flight. You know, it's he indulges in an extreme way. So there's the trauma, and then there's like the years of being completely out of it on drugs. So he has developed this obsessive persona, and all the concepts have been really indulged, but his style of his personality, you know, very much comes across in his writing, and it's kind of, you know, that it fits very well with the kind of straight talking cops that he so loves.
Yeah, and I enjoyed hearing him read as well, because I felt that he had this lovely reading manner, which is kind of half noir-y, half beat poet.
Yeah.
In a way. So yeah, if I had a chance to go and hear him read in person, I would definitely take it. I mean, he's not an easy character. He's a complex character. He doesn't fit neatly into any boxes. But I think, isn't that the joy of good literature? That we get to see life's complexities.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see it when it's messy and not neat and not perfect. So one of the criticisms that's often leveled at Elroy is that he's misogynistic, he's homophobic. And I can kind of really see why people come to that point of view, because he's not an easy guy. And he obviously has built quite a bit of his personality around being provocative as well. And there are times where I don't particularly like his wording or the way he tackles a subject. But there was also this bit in My Dark Places, which really stood out to me as being an incredibly feminist take. And I think for me, this illustrates what a complex character he actually is, that he is obsessed with women and he's obsessed with murdered women. But yeah, here, this is from the third part of My Dark Places. He learned something about murder early on. He learned that men killed with less provocation than women. Men killed because they were drunk, stoned, and pissed off. Men killed for money. Men killed because other men made them feel like sissies. Men killed to impress other men. Men killed so they could talk about it. Men killed because they were weak and lazy. Murder sated their lust of the moment and narrowed down their options to a comprehensible few. Men killed women for capitulating. The bitch wouldn't give them head or give them money. The bitch overcooked the steak. The bitch threw a fit when they traded her food stamps for dope. The bitch didn't like them pawing her 12-year-old daughter. Men did not kill women because they were systematically abused by the female gender. Women killed men because men fucked them over just that rigorously and persistently. He didn't consider the rule binding. He didn't want the rule to be true. He didn't want to see women as a whole race of victims. And I just think that is the most extraordinary feminist passage, and beautifully written.
Wonderfully written.
And I can see how in some ways he's a feminist. If you wrote that now, you'd immediately have like 200 incels on Twitter popping up going, not all men. But I think Elroy actually genuinely has an understanding of gender violence,
mm-hmm.
which you don't often see from a man.
Well, I think you do, I suppose, cops that have been doing this, all the people at that dinner in Feast of Murder, whatever it was called, Feast of Death, they all, you kind of build a sense of what people are like and what the tendencies are. And so you imagine that, you kind of, these truths get revealed through just repeated cases for decades.
I think he's also the kind of person, though. So LA cops were famous for being incredibly corrupt, particularly at the time Elroy's mainly writing about. And at one point, they were literally throwing their girlfriends and mistresses into asylums when the girlfriend or mistress was threatening to let his wife know what was happening if she got pregnant, if, any sort of slight misdemeanor that might in some way inconvenience them, they were like, well, I've got this power, I'm just gonna throw that woman away because it's the most convenient way for me to do things. So that is the heritage that the cops in that documentary are coming from. And they're obviously choosing
to see women differently.
Well, yeah, I think things have changed a lot since the 1940s, to be fair.
Yeah.
And I mean, the whole of society, of Western society, of the US society, has changed a lot since then as well. So,
but if you think that this stuff from Elroy is sort of 90s, early noughties, the cops in them are maybe 50, 60 years old, they'll have crossed paths.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's still corrupt cops out there, for absolutely. It's probably not quite as endemic and institutionalized as it was back then.
Where it's just easier to cover up and hide because people know what to avoid looking like. So I really enjoyed My Dark Places. I wasn't actually sure what to expect when I first started reading it. But I definitely want to read more Elroy. I think he's difficult, but I also think that's what's great about him.
Mm. Have you read any Elroy?
I think I maybe had to read some at uni.
Okay.
But it obviously did not leave much of an impression. I mean, to be honest, I'll have to listen to an audiobook because it's just too challenging for me to read off the page.
But you've seen LA Confidential.
Everybody's seen LA Confidential.
I read
Guy Pearce.
And I read The Black Dahlia, but I don't remember anything about The Black Dahlia, like the details of the actual killing and how he weaved that into his story. I'm not even sure. The only thing I really remember is the film, but I remember liking it. So yeah, I'll have to get stuck into some as well.
The next episode, we're going to look at Baby Reindeer, which I think it's fair to say we both really enjoyed.
Yeah, and we'll look at the way that deals with trauma.
A lot of the same themes, I think, going through both My Dark Places and Baby Reindeer. I was really glad when you suggested that we do a comparison because I hadn't thought of that. Well done, you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it... I was reading the book at the same time as we were watching the series, so that's why I saw the overlap. I don't know if I would have seen it otherwise. But yes, I think there's definitely, it's really interesting because it does, you know, two completely different places, two completely different types of people, two different ages, you know, it's remarkable, you know, to see the kind of the essence of trauma and how it manifests. So, yeah, join us then.
Yeah, join us for part two.
Yeah.
Elroy v's Reindeer.
Yep. Elroy v Gad.
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much for listening.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to True Crime Fiction, the podcast that is feeding your addiction to all things crime. You can find our website at true-crime-fiction.com, on Twitter at true_crime_fic, on Facebook and Instagram as True Crime Fiction. Please rate and review on the podcast app of your choice. Music is by Kitty Kitty Meow Meow.
I didn't realise it was right just outside LA.
It's 4 miles from the beach.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was further. I remember, yeah, the beach reference.
Or maybe it was 4 hours.
4 hours. It was something like, it was a lot. It was many hours.
Americans measure time rather than distance.
Yeah.
Have you noticed this?
Mm-hmm.
No, they always talk about a journey in the time it takes rather than the distance it takes. So they say in America, 100 years is a long time, and in Britain, 100 miles is a long distance.
Right. Okay.
You don't get it?
No.
So they don't really have a shit ton of history, at least as America, the colonized nation. They don't have a huge amount of history, so they think of 100 years as being like this really amazing long time, whereas we're all like, that's nothing.
Right, okay. But Britain's small, whereas America's big.
Yeah.
I get it now. Thank you.
Yeah.